Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, reactions continue to Pope Benedict's words expressing deep sorrow that Muslims have been offended by parts of his lecture at Regensburg University last week. We hear from British Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor and from a leading expert on Christian-Muslim dialogue. And good news for campaigners seeking an end to the use of the death penalty. A lay chaplain on Florida's death row says support for capital punishment in the United States has reached an all-time low. Welcome to the programme. Pope Benedict on Sunday said he was deeply sorry for the reactions by Muslims to parts of a lecture he gave at Regensburg University in Bavaria during the six-day visit to his homeland last week. In a lengthy lecture to professors and students, the Pope quoted from a medieval text which refers to criticism of the Prophet Muhammad by a 14th century Byzantine emperor. Addressing pilgrims gathered at his summer residence of Castel Gandolfo at midday on Sunday, the Pope said the quotations do not in any way express his personal thought, adding that the true meaning of his address was and is an invitation to frank and sincere dialogue with great mutual respect. My colleague Charles Collins takes a closer look at what the Pope had to say.
In questo momento desidero solo aggiungere che sono vivamente rammaricato.
At his Sunday Angelus, Pope Benedict said he was deeply sorry for the reactions in some countries to a few passages of his address at the University of Regensburg last week, which were considered offensive to the sensibilities of Muslims. Speaking at the papal summer residence in Castel Gandolfo, the Holy Father said the passages were, in fact, a quotation from a medieval text, which do not in any way express his personal thought. He pointed to the statement published on Saturday by the Cardinal Secretary of State, in which he explained the true meaning of the Pope's words.
Spero che questo valga a placare gli animi.
The Holy Father said that he hopes this serves to appease hearts and to clarify the true meaning of his address, which he said in its totality was and is an invitation to frank and sincere dialogue with great mutual respect. There have been several protests in Muslim countries since the address in Regensburg, which was meant as an academic lecture. After reciting the Angelus, the Holy Father spoke briefly in English.
May you stay here in Castel Gandolfo in Rome, be a time of spiritual enrichment, marked by the readiness to take up the cross and follow Jesus. Upon you and your loved ones, I invoke the grace and peace of Christ the Lord.
Pope Benedict also said he would speak more about his trip to Bavaria during his weekly general audience on Wednesday. I'm Charles Collins.
Benedict's words came one day after his new Secretary of State, Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone, also issued a statement underlining the Holy See's unequivocal commitment to interreligious and intercultural dialogue. That statement quotes from the Pope's own words to Muslim leaders in Cologne, Germany last year, when he stressed that Christian-Muslim dialogue cannot be reduced to an optional extra. The lessons of the past, he said, must help us to avoid repeating the same mistakes. We must seek paths of reconciliation and learn to live with respect for each other's identity. Well, one of the Church's leading experts on dialogue with the Islamic world is the director of the Pontifical Institute for Arabic and Islamic Studies here in Rome, Father Justo Lacunza. He talked to my colleague Lydia O'Kane about the Pope's words in Bavaria last week and the reactions from Muslims, which he sees as an opportunity for greater openness and understanding on both sides.
I think the Pope's intention was a twofold intention. first to link together the exercise of the reason and the word with the faith and the search for the divine. And secondly, he was trying to put across a very simple idea that any form of evil, of conflict, of war, of violence, it's against nature, it's against the very humanity of the human person, it's against faith, and no act of violence can have as a foundation religion or faith. And obviously, in that context, the Pope, I think, he has touched, if you like, and has opened doors and windows towards real problems in today's world, particularly when religion is being used as a base for violent actions or for war.
Now, the Pope did stress during the speech that they weren't his own words, that he was quoting the Emperor Manuel II, didn't he?
Yes. Well, he referred to a historical event of a meeting between Manuel II, called the Palaeologus, and a very prominent Persian scholar on the question of violence and the question of war. And the emperor referred to that verse in the Quran 2:256, which reads that there is no constraint in matters of religion. And then the emperor, of course, asked this Persian scholar, how is it possible? You try to, you know, to tell me, to explain to me, because I see different actions that have to do, you know, with violence and then based particularly on religion. And the Pope refers to that. And then the Pope sort of continues in his speech, and he makes this very, very powerful statement in which he says that you cannot put religion as the base of violence. In other words, if you commit a violent action, if you engage in conflict, in war against others, no matter who they are, you cannot say, I'm doing this in the name of God, because this is against the harmony of humanity. This is against faith itself. This is against religion. This is against God himself. And it is in that sense that the Pope touches a very, very sensitive issue in today's world. And I can understand, if you like, reactions from the Islamic world. And every time the question of conflict, the question of jihad, the question of war, the question of violence is being touched, then the reactions can be sort of very varied. But I will say one thing is that, for me, the Pope has sort of become the spokesman, if you like, for millions and millions of people around the world, including Muslims, who are telling you, and who how often have told me, scholars and simple Muslim people, as well, you know, we are not violent people. We do not want to link violence to Islam. We want to be Muslims. We want to be faithful Muslims. We want to continue building our own lives as the others. And in that sense, I think the Pope has not at all do that against Islam or against Muslims. On the contrary, he has a sort of caught the sensibilities of millions of Muslims and indirectly has told them, I said, look, I'm with you. You know, don't link violence with religion, and because the faith must illumine your path. The faith must illumine the path of every single believer and every single human being. And it is in this sense that the Pope is sort of, it's open to dialogue with other religions, to civilizations, and to cultures, precisely because we can reason about this, we can ask questions, we can use the word, and we can debate, we can discuss. Okay, if you do such an action, tell me why you do. We don't need, I think, to take up arms and put up a fight because we have different views and we have different opinions and we have different perceptions of faith and we have different visions. But there is one fundamental thing which lies at the very basis of everything, that religion and violence cannot be linked. We cannot say that we engage in violence and in war because It is religion which allows us to do so.
Finally, Father Lacunza, do you think that the Muslim community will come to see what the Pope was trying to get at?
Well, I think there are two important things to do. First, one has to understand the Pope's words and the Pope's speech. And I think we cannot extrapolate and take just simply a single thing. And they say, this is what the Pope said. And this is very, very striking. Even, I think, some media sort of have the reference of the Pope to a historical event has been taken, if you like, as if the Pope said, well, these are my words. And I think one needs to be extremely careful in order to understand exactly what the Pope has said. And secondly, I think the Islamic world, and I think scholars and Muslims who live in the midst of other religions and other cultures and other civilizations, will discuss, and we can argue, we can talk, we can debate. We can say that this world, it is not the propriety of anybody. It's, we all belong to this world, and whatever happens in this world, in matters of religions, in matters of economy, in matters of conflicts and wars, in matters of faith, in matters of religion, that's our concern. And we do have, quite a number of problems regarding violence and regarding conflicts in the world. Well, you know, perhaps it is an occasion to discuss and debate, but I'm not surprised of the reactions. I think the reactions are always very healthy and very sound, although at times and very often they are painful and they hurt. They do not hurt my sensibilities personally, but I can understand that these reactions would hurt the sensibilities of a lot of people. I think it's an occasion for greater improvement in our openness, if you like, to the others, in our openness to other people's expectations, faiths and cultures. It is a tremendous occasion also for the Church to renew itself and to say, you know, let us not have any thought of evil in our hearts, because evil and violence cannot be have religion or text as a base for action.
Father Justo Lacunza, director of the Pontifical Institute for Arabic and Islamic Studies here in Rome. That call for openness and understanding at this difficult time has been echoed by Catholic leaders in other countries, many of whom have been working hard to improve relations with Muslim communities since the Second Vatican Council officially expressed the Church's esteem for followers of Islam over four decades ago. British Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor on Sunday stood alongside Muslim and Jewish leaders praying for peace in war-torn Darfur. This practical sign of interfaith solidarity came one day after the Cardinal issued a statement to be read in all Catholic parishes in his Diocese of Westminster.
Well, it was a very short message, but really saying to all the Catholic people in the diocese that Pope Benedict, in his lecture, was essentially appealing for a dialogue of cultures which was based on faith and on reason. And it was quite clear to me that Pope Benedict had no intention of offending in any way the sensibilities of the Muslim community. And the Holy Father himself has expressed his sorrow if any passage in his speech sounded offensive to Muslim believers. I mean, what was clear to me was that his lecture is a radical rejection of any religious motivation for violence. That seemed to me to be an extraordinarily important thing to say. I then went on to say that if we would continue in our country to develop good relations with the Muslim community based on mutual respect and a common desire for justice and peace in our world. So it was a very short message, but something I thought our people would be happy to hear.
Over recent years there in Britain, you've worked hard, haven't you, to foster good relations with the Muslim community. Have you had any reactions from the Muslim leadership about all this?
Well, as yet, I mean, personally to myself, not very many, except that yesterday when I was standing with some Muslim leadership with regard to the situation in Darfur, there was an expression there of common solidarity and understanding, and I was grateful for that.
Tell us a little bit about this. It was a day of prayer, wasn't it, for the people of Darfur? Can you give us some more details?
Essentially, five Muslim leaders, five Christian leaders, and five Jewish leaders went to Downing Street and read out a prayer each, calling for reconciliation, for peace, and for the intervention of the international community in Darfur. We said that the situation was getting worse and worse, and we didn't want another Rwanda. And so in different ways, we expressed this very firmly. And the British government, in terms of the Tony Blair's representative, Baroness Amos, expressed their acceptance of this and their efforts to do all they could with other countries to alleviate and to stop immediately the terrible fighting, the starvation, the violence in the Sudan, and particularly in Darfur.
And my thanks there to Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor, head of the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Now for some good news for all those who have long been campaigning for an end to the use of the death penalty. In recent months, the United States has seen an unprecedented amount of soul-searching over the ethics of state executions. New concerns raised by doctors and lawyers about lethal injection, the most widely used method of execution in the United States, have raised the debate to a new intensity. These concerns were the driving force behind a series of recent court rulings that have blocked executions in a number of states. Other concerns relate to the advent of DNA testing that has proven innocent people have been wrongly convicted, along with evidence of inconsistent applications of the death penalty. Dale Resinella is a Catholic chaplain who ministers to prisoners on death row in the state of Florida. He spoke to my colleague Susie Hodges about what he sees as a definite waning of support for the death penalty across the United States at large.
There's no question, Susie, that there is a broad reexamination of the death penalty taking place at every level. And that is true with respect to average Americans. At least that's what I find as I go around Florida and the United States speaking on the death penalty. It also seems to be true at the highest levels. In a decision that came down at the end of the U.S. Supreme Court term, called Marsh versus Kansas, there was a hotly divided U.S. Supreme Court, 5-4, on the issue of whether or not the American death penalty poses extreme risk of executing the innocent. Now, unfortunately, the five justices that sustained Kansas on their death penalty statute were the five Catholics. The four dissenters who were extremely concerned about innocence and the failure of the American death penalty to properly identify not just those who are guilty of the worst crimes, but those who are guilty at all, were the four non-Catholics on the U.S. Supreme Court. The good news in that is that if just one of the Catholic U.S. Supreme Court justices accepts and incorporates the teaching of the Catholic Church on the death penalty, the 5-4 decision will go the other way and the death penalty in the United States will be over.
You talked about the fact that it was the Catholics that were supporting the death penalty. Has this been noticed by other people? Has it been taken up? What interpretations have been given to this?
Well, if this had been a 5-4 decision on other life issues like stem cell research or euthanasia, and the only five justices supporting it were the conservative Catholics, I would have expected an explosion of discussion of this in the media. especially in the Catholic media. But in this decision, it has not even been mentioned, let alone discussed thoroughly, as far as I can tell. But as I said, I consider it a hopeful sign that if just one of the five Catholic justices on the U.S. Supreme Court accepts Catholic teaching on the death penalty in America will stop.
So it's definitely fair to say that there's been a noticeable waning in support for the death penalty, shall we say, in recent years.
No question. The American love affair with the death penalty appears to have peaked around 1994 to 1996. That was the height of public support, around 80% or even a little higher. It was the height of death sentences, with over 300 death sentences being handed down every year in the United States. Now, we're looking at a situation where general public support for the death penalty at all is somewhere around 64 to 65%. And in almost all the polls, when the people being asked the question are given the option of life imprisonment without possibility of parole, the support for the death penalty drops to 50% or lower. Now, as far as American Catholics, back in the mid-90s and the late 90s, their poll showings for support for the death penalty were right with the general public. But as we saw in the Zogby International poll last year, because I believe of the effectiveness of the Catholic Church teaching and the American bishops getting the word out, Catholic support for the American death penalty has dropped to 48%. And those who are regular churchgoers, those who are practicing their faith, are the least likely Catholics to support the American death penalty. The size of death row has decreased. The number of death sentences has decreased. The number of executions has decreased. There's no question that all the trend lines are pointing to a disuse and less use of this practice, and hopefully soon an elimination of it, because they will be doing such few executions and death sentences that the extreme cost of the death penalty will force politicians to back away from it.
Now, there must be obviously many factors playing into this new, shall we say, change of heart or this new trend. Do you think one of the chief concerns has been, in fact, the worries over lethal injections and whether they are an ethical and, above all, pain-free method of execution?
That certainly has risen to the fore as a major concern. I would put it number two, right behind concerns about executing the innocent. And of course, the whole concern about the issue of lethal injection being an extremely cruel and painful method of execution has risen in the media and in the public consciousness since spring of 2005, when the British medical journal Lancet published an extensive study showing that the overwhelming majority of executions which they had studied the medical data from indicated a high likelihood that the men executed had experienced excruciating pain in the process of their death. The reason for this is the combination of the three chemicals that are used in all 38 of the 39 states which have the death penalty and use lethal injection. And of course, the primary culprit is a chemical that paralyzes the involuntary muscles, and thus the person, while still conscious, experiences suffocation. The U.S. Supreme Court, in their decision allowing inmates to appeal this issue, seemed to be greatly affected by the fact that the use of this chemical is prohibited in most states for the euthanization of animals because of its potential to inflict unnecessary extreme pain.
And I know that, you know, the concerns that have been raised by this whole issue of lethal injections, that it's led to a spate of appeals, and they've managed to delay executions in several states, haven't they?
Yes, as of right now, there are approximately a dozen states in the United States where executions are on hold because appeals of the procedure are before the courts. In states like California and Missouri, the appeals are literally up against a wall because the federal courts have ordered that in order for lethal injection to go forward as the means of execution, it must be overseen by competent, certified medical professionals. In Missouri, the court ordered it must be overseen by an anesthesiologist, which is a board-certified doctor with a specialty in anesthesia. But the AMA, the American Medical Association, has in its ethics guidelines that it is unethical for a doctor to participate in the killing of a human being. And the ASA, the Anesthesiologists Society, has issued a letter reminding its 40,000 members that it's unethical for an anesthesiologist to participate in the killing of a human being. And some of the states then decided they would get emergency medical technicians to do it. And the EMT Association has made sure that they have reminded all their members that it is unethical for an emergency medical technician to participate in the killing of a human being. So California and Missouri, and probably soon other states, will be back in the courts saying the requirement that a medical professional must oversee these human killings is tantamount to ending the death penalty in our state because there are no medical professionals who will participate in this.
You mentioned that you thought the number one reason behind this trend away from support for the death penalty is the fear that innocent people have been put to death. Now, is this because of the advent of DNA testing, or is it more because of an intrinsic unfairness in the way the trials are conducted, in the way that the death penalty tends to target the poor, the people from the minorities?
I would say, Susie, it's all of the above, but clearly DNA has punched a hole in the public's comfort level that the criminal justice system only finds the actually guilty guilty. It only convicts those who are actually guilty. That has been a presupposition culturally as long as I've been around, and the fact that almost 200 people have come out of prison, 14 of them off death rows, with conclusive DNA evidence that they could not have been the one that committed this crime, has really rocked the American public's confidence that the system only convicts the guilty.
Catholic lay chaplain Dale Resinella talking to my colleague Susie Hodges. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, for today, but we'll be back on the air at this same time tomorrow. And don't forget, you can always find us on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.